Today I'm interviewing Howard Rock. He's the editor of Tundra Times, and he was where were you born?
I was born at Point Hope, a little village in the far northwestern part of Alaska. It's way up there, somewhere between, on the coast, somewhere between Nome and Barrow.
How did you get involved with Tundra Times?
Well, I got involved without knowing that I would be involved as much as I am in it at the moment. But I was very much interested in having a newspaper or newsletter started back in 1961. And along with some of the people, we had discussed this possibility for many months, that it was needed because the problems of the Eskimos and Indians and Aleuts were not always publicized in the existing press then. And when it finally was time for us to start publishing, I didn't know I was going to be the editor, but I was sort of forced to get into it because the man who finally backed the paper to start publishing, the late Dr. Henry S. Forbes, insisted that I become the editor.
What are some of the problems you faced when Tundra Times was first started?
Well, one of the first things that I had to face was that I didn't have any experience in newspaper work. And I tried to protest on account of this. I tried to protest to Dr. Forbes that I didn't have the experience in any newspaper up to that time. And but he wouldn't listen, and he said he would back the Tundra Times only if I agreed to be the editor. So I was kind of forced to be the editor of the Tundra Times.
What is the importance of Tundra Times, like when Native Land Claim was started? Tundra Times was the one that was voicing out the people. What is the importance now after the land claims have been settled?
Well, a lot of people thought that since the land claim settlement has been resolved, that there wouldn't be much need for the Tundra Times to keep on publishing. But I told the people then that the work has just started, even though the land claims itself, the effort to win the land claims effort, was a major effort of all the existing leadership then and now, that it was very important. But I told people after the claim settlement that the work has just started, because the implementation of the act, the Land Claims Act, would offer a lot of problems, a lot of new problems for the native areas, and which is very true. And they have from hunting economy and into corporations of rather large corporations too. These regional corporations, our native people have jumped into these areas readily, even though they have not been trained for years to handle such things. But they are doing well, as far as I know, because I think that their background of existing and subsisting in the land of severe surroundings have had a lot to do with their reasoning and abilities to meet all kinds of problems.
I've heard from some of the people that your family is long line of whalers. Why did you get interested in Tundra Times instead of whaling?
Well, my ancestors all the way back, I don't know when, they were very great whalers, and including my father and my late brother. They were all very fine whale hunters, and which is a very difficult way of hunting because of the equipment. In the old days, you know, they had to use nothing but hand-driven harpoons, but with the skills they acquired through the centuries, apparently, that they were able to capture these huge mammals that once in a while they get them up to 80 tons. And my late brother, Alan Rock, he managed to get a whale that weighed about 50 tons one spring at back in 1961. And so, therefore, my family members, reaching way back, had been whaling, and they were very successful. And but as for myself, Alan used to tell me, my late brother used to tell me that, you know, Howard, you're the only man in our family who hasn't caught a whale. Which didn't make me feel very good, but I was very busy working with the Tundra Times and trying to help our people meet their many problems then, and those problems are still with us. But with the efforts we have been made in the past 12 years, much of it through the Tundra Times, these problems that were very difficult and all that are being tackled by such agencies from Congress of the United States and the state government. Well, the importance of the Tundra Times since the land claim settlement was resolved from my point of view, continues to be an important one, because I felt after the claims were settled that the work was just beginning, information and reporting of the effort of our native people would still be very necessary. Therefore, I told people then after this claim settlement that Tundra Times would continue to be important to our native folks in rural areas. And it is a very important media, because it continues to point out the problems and achievements of our people after the claim settlement. This is, I believe, is a very important thing to do, because it would be very much part of history of our native people, and this history is going to be very important in the future generations of our Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts in Alaska.
When Tundra Times was started, what was the reaction of the other newspapers?
Well, the reaction of the other papers was rather negative when we started publishing, and some people predicted that we wouldn't last a month, but here we are going into our 12th year of publishing, and even though we had a very difficult time trying to stay above water during the 12 years, but we are going along, getting along better. And we will be, we will continue to publish as far as I can see, because our situation is getting so much better, and then we can keep right on publishing.
What was the reaction of the native peoples when Tundra Times was first started?
Well, the people then didn't know exactly what to think of it, and I don't blame them, because it was a very new thing, something that has never been done before in the way we did it, and which right off the bat we had to publicize very complex matters like the land claims and sanitation problems of the village areas and terrible housing conditions and many other great problems the native people have experienced through the many years since they have come in contact with the so-called Western culture.
You were talking about something about safe water, or can you tell me something about that Safe Water Act?
Well, since we started the publishing the Tundra Times, we have tackled, among other problems, the water situation of our villages, which is very bad at the moment. And where they used to have some immunity against the drinking water they used to drink then, now their immunity has fallen because of consumption of white men's foods. And this fact, I'm told it's true, this has worn down the immunity of our people to drink the water they used to drink. And now children are beginning to get sick, and this of course, is a very worrisome problem to the Tundra Times and to our staff and to many village families and leaders throughout Alaska.
Since this Sea Mammal Act has been passed, I've heard this remark from some people. Why should natives have to hunt? What is your reaction toward that?
Well, you can't do away with the tradition that has sustained people like our native people in Alaska for centuries and centuries. And this, the subsistence hunting and the lifestyle that was established centuries ago is going to be a very strong factor even today and far into the future, I believe, because it was a way our people made their living, and they developed cultures that revolved around hunting and animals, different animals, like in my village of Point Hope. The culture of the people there is mainly around hunting of the bowhead whale. And this is a very important animal to them because one whale usually supports a village of about 350 to 375 for many months. And when they get more than that, when they get four or five or six, that was even much better because it assures food supply for a whole year. And you might wonder that how they stored this huge amount of meat in muktuk. The old-timers from way back, the ancient people, developed what could be called the original deep freeze. And this was a way of digging into the permafrost and making chambers at different levels. And the deepest chamber was used to store whale meat and muktuk. And the upper levels were used to store ugruk meat and walrus meat and other meats. By the way, this we call it sikhlok, which is a underground freezing chamber. Being in the permafrost level, the meat of the muktuk of the whale, the muktuk and meat would freeze during summer and keep frozen even in summertime, and therefore it could be used for year-round consumption.
I know you're an accomplished artist. Can you say something about art? I don't know too much about art. Maybe you can say more about art than me.
Well, art was a very important thing to me ever since I was a youngster. And this also came out during the time I was going to high school at White Mountain Industrial School, which was about 75 miles east of Nome. And there I happened to have a teacher who happened to have a painting set of oils and brushes and linseed oil and all that stuff that was necessary for oil painting. And since I was interested in art, she encouraged me to try painting one summer, which I did, and found that I was having a very, very, very fine and unusual experience doing paintings of my own, and which I thought was I was quite thrilled that happened, because since that time I have gotten much stronger feeling for art.
Does that help you preparing your Tender Times?
Well, Tender Times has a nice little reputation as having had a pretty nice looking front page through the years. And this, I believe, has originated from my ideas of art, because I was taught composition and balance and everything like that in art. And when I make up the front page, well, these things come to me, and I sort of plan the front page, always conscious of balance and of the things I put on the front page and in other pages as well.
Since our social culture have changed greatly since the native land claim, what do you think are some of the problems that our people might face?
Well, I believe that our native people will lose in time much of their very traditional things. But some of our people are also very much serious. They're very serious in keeping alive some of their old traditions and cultures and customs, which had given them a lot of strength and spirit through the ages as they existed. And these are very precious things, and I believe that they will make a pretty strong effort to keep a lot of these very beautiful old traditions that have sustained them through the ages. And I hope they will do it. And of course, like I said, some of this might be lost, but as well, even now, in 1975, the first part of this year, even now, some of our cultural facets are being absorbed by white people from different states from the lower 48. And these people are beginning to wear parkas and mukluks, and as well as learning to eat some of the native foods, and which they like very much. And some of this exchange is going on, and it will go on into the future. And I believe that in time, Alaska will never be like New York. It'll have its own, perhaps, very charming cultural heritage, which will never be anything like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C. But it'll be, I think, very pleasant and that is something peculiar unto its own, very Alaskan, and very charming.
You got, excuse me, you got anything that you'd like to add that I might not be aware of?
Well, I would like to say that we have been going on with the Thunder Times ever since October 1, 1962. And this period has a history of tremendous problems we had to meet in order to keep publishing. And some of the times we have had to go without pay for some weeks because we didn't have enough to pay our help. And although this is always facing us, but we are operating a little better, and we can always use a little help from anybody who might want to subscribe, because we feel that Tundra Times is one of the most informative and honest, I might say, that dispenses news in that manner, and therefore, everything or anything that is read within the contents of the Tundra Times is very worthwhile to absorb by any person anywhere in the world.
I forgot one thing. I know you have two programs every year. What are those two programs you sponsor?
Well, one of the most well-known program we Tundra Times has been putting on for the last several years is the Eskimo Indian Olympics. This program is put on usually around the last 2 days of July and the first day of August. And this has become a very popular performance for anybody, both native people and white folks from anywhere, even from Europe and even from Asia. In fact, the Eskimo Indian Olympics have been filmed by Japanese and CBS in Canada and Walt Disney people also came up some years ago to do some filming, and it has gotten to be a very spectacular and amusing spectacle that we put on every year during the time I mentioned.
When is your next Eskimo Olympic going to be held?
The next Olympics will be held on August 30, no, excuse me, it'll be July 30, 31, and August 1. And during the, it should be another one of a very interesting programs that a lot of people will want to see, because we have been getting inquiries about it from the lower 48, as well as the state chamber of commerce and many other sources.
That's going to be held this summer. What is the other one? I think it's Tundra Times Banquet.
Yeah, Tundra Times Banquet is another one we established some years ago, and we sort of shot an arrow into the air, and where it fell, we didn't know. Where it would fell, we didn't know. But we held one for the first time here in Fairbanks, and it happened to turn out, although we just broke even in doing it, it just happened that it was very funny and very amusing spectacle. So since that time, we have been holding our annual banquets, and in those banquets we have invited people such as the then Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall and Vincent Price, the actor, and Jack Anderson of the famous Washington Merry-Go-Round, Gene Dixon, the famous series, and last year in Anchorage banquet we held, we had Buffy St. Marie, and we will pretty soon now we'll start working for our next guest. And we like to, if we can get them, we like to get the you know, these people who are famous for what they did for show business and other endeavors in their lives. And these have turned out to be very attractive and interesting to the people who go to our banquets.
I read in one of the papers that you got the paper got nominated for Pulitzer Prize. What was the reaction of Tundra Times people?
Well, since it came out of the blue completely, that we were very much surprised to have been mentioned by the very prestigious Pulitzer Prize Foundation. And of course, we were very happy about it, and we found out. I got a short letter from New York, a few weeks ago, informing me that the Tundra Times had been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and this is a very, very fine thing, of course. And of course, we realize also that we'll have a terrific amount of competition throughout the nation, and but we, you know, hope springs eternal in our little office here in Tundra Times organization, and although we might not get it, we are very happy that we have been mentioned and actually nominated for this very prestigious award.
You already had Pulitzer Prize from your people here in Alaska. I know you've gotten some honors. What are some of the honors you've gotten here in Alaska?
Well, when I started getting these things, I was very much surprised because I have never worked for any honor during my job publishing and editing the Tundra Times. And one of the first honors that I very much cherish was came from Point Hope, my little old village, and commending me on the efforts I was doing. And it was one of the nicest awards I ever got. It, and it had with it a certificate along with a gold-plated pen marked the Council of Point Hope or something like that. That was very, very, very nice award, and I still have that certificate with me here. And this is very great honor indeed for my own people, my own villagers at Point Hope. And subsequently, I have gotten other awards and from different areas. And one of the very fine awards I received has been the my election to the Alaskan of the Year in 1974. This is a statewide thing put on by the Alaska Press Club throughout the state, and I was elected to be the winner. I was a co-winner along with the United States Senator Ted Stevens, and last year, when was it? Just recently. I was also elected 49er of the Year, which is put on by the local Anchorage members of the Alaska Press Club. And this is a very fine honor also, and all these honors are very, very fine, which gives me great pleasure that I, you know, to receive them. Although I have never consciously worked for anything like that. These are things that I receive without actually trying for any awards, because I don't think about anything like that when I'm working for our people and for the good of people throughout the state. Because Tender Times also, although it publicizes the native oriented problems and other things, we have also noticed that some of the things we have publicized also are of some help to the general population of Alaska.
What about the one you got from University of Alaska?
Well, that was very fine. It has a special meaning to me because it was something very new, and that was I was made given an honorary doctor's degree called the Humane Letters. And this I got last year in May, I believe, at the University of Alaska. And this, you know, this will always have a very warm spot in my heart for having received it. And, of course, it's, along with that, it's a terrific honor to have received it, because it's the University of Alaska is a public institution for the whole state, and this is this carries with it a lot of prestige. I'm very, very happy to have received it.
How do you subscribe to Tundra Times?
Well, Tundra Times is a statewide paper. We go throughout Alaska, and we also go throughout much of the lower 48 and Canada and some foreign countries like England and Netherlands and Germany. And we hear from Asian countries. We also have subscribers in Japan and many other areas. And this, we are very proud of having those subscribers from these different areas, because they're so far reaching and all that. And we also like subscribers from anywhere, close by here in the city of Fairbanks and city of Anchorage, and which we have. But we can always welcome additional subscribers from anywhere, and we are thinking. The reason for this thinking is that the postage, U.S. postage mailing, has gone up, and we're thinking of raising the subscription rate of the Tundra Times from $10 to $15 a year. And this, we believe, will go into effect sometime in July.
Can you give me the address when you subscribe?
Well, all you do is just simply, if anyone subscribes before July the 1st, well, they will be able to get it for the old rate of $10 a year. And the address you sent to is Tundra Times, Box 1287, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99707.
Thank you very much. This has been Levi Lott interviewing Howard Rock, the editor of Tundra Times and distinguished Alaskan. I'm going to interview Howard Rock, and he's going to give me a brief history of his life.
Well, earlier I said I was born at Point Hope, which is a village in the far northwestern part of Alaska. And one of the first things I noticed when I began to see around me my environment was that I was It's very cold up there in at Point Hope, although the temperatures don't always go down as far as some areas in Alaska, go down as far as below zero, I mean. But the wind blows up there a great deal. Sometimes when you have 30 below zero weather or 35 below zero with about 45-mile wind behind it, that can be very uncomfortable weather for anyone, because the chill factor would be way up somewhere around 80 degrees below zero, probably, maybe perhaps more. But we dress for such weather at Point Hope, and the women up there, along with their men, have designed some clothing that was very useful and proper for the climate. And these are usually caribou or reindeer skin type things, or marmot or muskrat and animals like that. And they are very fine for winter wear. And one of the things, of course, that the Eskimos apparently had invented was the invention of the hood. This is a very fine thing to have in anywhere when you live in Arctic Alaska. The hood is a very useful thing to have on a parka. Well, anyway, my history. Well, I went to school at started going to grade school at Point Hope when I was a very young boy. I don't even remember some of my first days of schooling, because my mother told me and my father told me that I had gone to school for the first time when I was 3 years old. And of course, I don't remember some of the happenings at school, but later on, I kept going to school, but the first schooling I had was under the Episcopal Church, and when they established the St. Thomas Mission at Point Hope. But the missionaries then had many difficulties in getting the school going, because of one trouble they had was they couldn't keep their teachers for over a year, and 1 year of teaching was usually enough, so the teachers, after spending a year at Point Hope, well, would go back to Lower 48 on the old, famous old cutter bear, you know, the famous old revenue cutter bear, which made annual trips up to Point Hope and other areas in the old days. And from Point Hope, I was chosen as one of the youngsters to go to White Mountain Industrial School, which was a school that was operated under the Bureau of Education, the forerunner of the present Bureau of Indian Affairs. And I went there and finished my grade schooling and then went on to high school. And then from there, after I graduated, I worked my way out on the original North Star, the wooden freighter ship that freighted supplies to schools and hospitals, government hospitals and schools on coastal Alaska. And I landed in Seattle, and from there I traveled by train. It was the first train I ever traveled on the train from Seattle to Portland. And from Portland to Medford, Oregon, where I met my future teacher, Max Sims, the artist with whom I studied art for a year and a half. After that, Mr. Sims decided that I needed some more technical training in a regular art school, so we chose University of Washington in Seattle, and there I went to, after working on a ship on the North Star, visiting my folks at Point Hope, I entered University of Washington back in 1935, I believe, 34 or 35. And before I got there, well, we had made arrangements for me to get an educational loan from the Bureau of Education, which was $900 a year, and which I had to pay back later, and I had a hard time doing it, but I paid it back. And we got that $900 a year to go to school at University of Washington, which I majored in art. And I went 3 years, and going into the third year and completing the third year, I couldn't live on $900 a year, so I had to drop out from my art schooling. And thereafter, I began to look for a job in the city of Seattle, and managed to get one in the at a jewelry store, and for which I designed ivory pieces for bracelets and brooches and other things, and steak knives and carving sets. The Eskimo scenes, whaling scenes and seals and polar bears and walrus and all that sort of stuff. This I did for quite a few years until I was drafted into the Army Air Force during the Second World War. And I was drafted, and I got my, I was sent to Fort Lawton.
Fort Lauderdale.
No. Fort Lewis. Fort Lewis in near Tacoma, Washington. And from there, they give us all kinds of tests, and I, without knowing it, I managed to make pretty good grades in instruments and radio. And I was told that I made good grades in those two categories, so. So they asked me which one I would like to take, and so I took radio because I have always been fascinated the way they did send messages and receive messages by dots and dash, and which is Morse code. And after that I was sent to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, for basic training in radio. And after I advanced a little bit, well, I was sent to Madison, Wisconsin, and I graduated there at 25 words a minute in Morse code, and which I took down by using a typewriter. After that, I was sent to Smyrna, Tennessee, near Nashville, and to train for what was supposed to have been the actual procedures in operating in foreign countries like Europe. And after that, I was shipped to near Norfolk, Virginia, and from there, I was shipped across Atlantic on a huge convoy, ships numbering about 80 that was crossing the Atlantic to bring supplies and men to European operation of the United States during the war. And the convoy separated in two at Gibraltar, and the rest of us that were left there were landed at Oran in Algeria. And after staying in Oran for a while, I was shipped to Tunisia, first to Algiers, the big city in Algeria, and then to Tunis in Tunisia. And there I started operating, and when I got there, the operating radio was quite different than what was supposed to be at the final training I got on it, and it was altogether different. And therefore, we had to learn all over again how to actually operate outside of the United States. And managed to learn that, and before I was through, I was I could receive about 45 words a minute on the typewriter, and send, you can always send faster than you can receive. I could send about 50 words on what they call the bug.
That's a minute.
Yeah, that's 50 words a minute. And I enjoyed operating the radio, and later on we had to discard Morse code and go into radio teletype. And this we had to learn also, learn how to operate, and which we did. And I worked at this assignment, radio work, until I was shipped back from North Africa to New York. By the way, I landed in Tunis, Tunisia, just after General Rommel of the German army was chased out of that area, and I also was operating during the time when General Patton slapped that GI in Sicily. And I was also operating, and I couldn't get out of my position after the D-Day in France and Germany. President Franklin Roosevelt landed at Eleuni Air Base, where I was. But I had to be at my position, so I didn't get to see the actual landing or anything like that. But he did land there while we were operating, and of course we never knew what we were sending or receiving, because all the traffic we handled was encoded messages. So we never knew what we were sending or receiving. Anyway, I came back to the United States, And I started working again in jewelry business, and after that I had a chance to go to Point Hope back in 1961 in June. And when I got up there, of course I was welcomed by my folks and everybody else, and I found out that they were having trouble with the Atomic Energy Commission. The commission had been planning to explode atomic devices to create a harbor at the nearby 30 miles southeast of Point Hope, at nearby Cape Thompson. And the people were very much worried about this, because they have been informed that If these devices were exploded, that it would contaminate with the oceans and the country around there. And of course, Point Hope always have lived on marine animals like seals, whales, ugruks, walrus, and caribou, and many other animals and fish. And it was thought, and very much rightly so, I think, that these marine mammals and fish and caribou would be contaminated by radiation from the detonation area at Cape Thompson. And from there, well, the folks wanted me to help them protest the AEC. and writing letters for the council and a letter to the then Secretary of the Interior, Stuart Udall. And after that, an organization from New York with New York headquarters, Association on American Indian Affairs, took a hold of this letter and started helping the Point Hope people. And that was the first time that we were heard officially by the Congress of congressional members of the United States and the Interior Department and other departments. And in time, the plan, AC plan, to explode the atomic devices was dropped. By the way, that project was called Project Chariot. And after landing at Point Hope, I began to do some sketching, and later on I started painting pictures of the scenes, as native scenes usually, what I usually saw and experienced at Point Hope. And these were whaling and other things, and I also did some paintings of ruins of old sod igloos, ancient sod igloos, and ancient graves. And from there, one day I had a chance to have to hold an exhibit of my art, my work at Point Hope in Fairbanks. And I took the chance and traveled to Fairbanks and had an art show, and which came out very, very nice at that time, you know, money-wise, and which I had needed a great deal. And the show was successful, and during that time we also started talking about the possibility of having some kind of a publication or a newsletter that would concern itself with the problems of the native people of Alaska, the Indians, Aleuts, and Eskimos. And we kept talking about this, and sometime in August of 1962, I got a call from Dr. Henry S. Forbes, a medical doctor, who decided to back the paper. And then he said that he would back it under one condition, that I be the editor. And since that time, I had been the editor of the Tundra Times.
Thank you very much.